This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, standing in the lobby of the Hart Senate office building on Capitol Hill, where I sat down for a lengthy conversation with U.S. Senator John Cornyn. I asked him about the bill he co-authored with Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer, calling for Americans affected by 9/11 to be allowed to sue the Saudi government, about the state of the Republican Party, and I asked him about his relationship to Senator Ted Cruz. Senator Cornyn, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
You co-authored a bill with Senator Chuck Schumer, the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, to allow Americans affected by 9/11 to sue Saudi Arabia for damages. What evidence convinced you that the Saudi government was somehow complicit in those acts of terrorism?
Well, the bill isn't specifically addressing Saudi Arabia, but as you know, there's 28 pages left out of the 9/11 report, which the president now says he will likely release, which allegedly implicate some individuals in the Saudi government. This bill would amend a 1976 statute called the Foreign Sovereignty Act, what it would do is specifically remove the requirement that it be a state-sponsored terrorist, country from a state sponsor of terrorism. For example, Iran, you may have seen recently, there was $2 billion judgment upheld by the Supreme Court, but they've been designated by the Department of State as a state sponsor of international terrorism. So what this would do would be to remove that requirement, so it would be more broadly applicable against terrorist activities, and it also is limited to terrorist activities that occur on American soil. So it's actually pretty narrow. But it could, if the facts lead in that direction, affect some people in Saudi Arabia. There's no denying that.
The president has said he would veto the bill if it passes. He went to Saudi Arabia last week to try to sue the ruffled feathers. How much does it matter if the passage of this bill, if it happens, disrupts diplomatic relations with Saudi Arabia?
Well, I think the claim that it will disrupt that relationship is overrated. What really disrupted the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia was the Iranian nuclear deal, which the Saudis justly, in my view, felt like provided an existential threat to them. The idea that Iran would at some point develop nuclear weapons and that would be okay with the world community, even though they are a state sponsor of international terrorism. So this, I don't believe, is going to change that relationship. I do believe that justice for the victims of 9/11 is important. And I do believe that this would provide an opportunity for them to seek justice and would not irreparably harm this relationship.
If the Saudis divest themselves of $750 billion in U.S. assets, as they've said they would do, what would be the economic impact on the United States?
Well, I think you have to doubt, I doubt whether they would divest themselves of their holdings in the United States, because essentially what they would do is drive their own bond prices down and hurt themselves in the process. I think it's a hollow threat, and I don't think that if they did sell off some of their bonds, I don't think it would have a negative impact on the U.S. economy. I think it would be relatively insignificant.
Any concerns that other countries would pass legislation, some say in retaliation, to match what the U.S. would do with this?
Well, I mentioned a moment ago that this legislation is actually is part of the Foreign Sovereignties Immunities Act. It would amend a 1976 statute. So what I'm suggesting has really already been the law of the land, not as presently proposed, but the whole idea of, in some narrow circumstances, sovereign immunity of other countries would not be honored, has not led to this parade of horribles that some of the critics have claimed, and I don't think this would either.
You have said that you think the next president should be the one to fill the vacancy left on the Supreme Court by the death of Justice Scalia. Why?
Well, part of it is because the judicial confirmation process has become hopelessly politicized over the last few years. You may recall that even when Clarence Thomas was confirmed to the United States Supreme Court, he actually was confirmed with 52 votes. It was only when George W. Bush became president that my Democratic friends said that 40 senators could essentially deny, or 41 deny a presidential appointee. In other words, they could filibuster those nominees. And there's been a series of comments by Joe Biden, Harry Reid, Chuck Schumer, leading me to believe that if the shoe were on the other foot, they would have done the same thing. I would say that it's not an unreasonable position, in my view, to say that the voters who are choosing the next president should be the one to make that decision. I can understand the president doesn't like it. The Constitution does give him the authority to make the nomination, but it gives the Senate the unilateral authority to either grant or withhold consent. And in this case, we've said that we are going to withhold consent. We'll see how it all turns out after the election. There may be some that say, well, this proved to be a good idea, and others to say, well, maybe it wasn't so good.
There are people who argue that the voters had their say when they elected President Obama for a second term.
I've read that. I would say to them that the voters also had their say when they elected a Republican majority in the Senate in 2014, recognizing that I think that was an expression that the voters wanted a check on presidential power by the president, and this is one way to provide that.
Do you think future presidents should commit to not filling vacancies in the final years of their terms if they come up unexpectedly?
I think this will change the debate. I would hope that we could somehow declare a truce and say, let's return to the good old days when nominees were processed without the hyper-politicalization. But I don't see that happening anytime soon. So I think as a practical matter, what this will do is set a precedent that will make it difficult, absent a negotiated resolution, to fill those vacancies occurring late in the president's term.
Primary season is always fractious for both parties. Are you concerned this year about the divisions you're seeing within the Republican Party?
Well, it's unprecedented in my experience. Used to be in the Republican Party, the arguments were more about who was the true conservative and who was not, and at least of late. And now with Mr. Trump's entry into the presidential primary, it's more of a populist, not an ideological message. I would say that it's not just in the Republican primary, it's also in the Democratic primary, as exemplified by Bernie Sanders. And I think been quite a surprise to Mrs. Clinton, who thought she was going to win that nomination without much of a fight. I'm not pessimistic, I'm not despairing. I think, you know, self-government is kind of a messy business, and this has proven to be messier than many people would have thought. But I think it also reflects the level of frustration people feel at the status quo and the inability of the two major political parties to basically solve some of our biggest problems. And this is definitely changing the terms of the debate and discussion.
Do you consider Donald Trump a Republican?
If he considers himself a Republican, I consider him a Republican. That's really a broad spectrum. Yes, if he does, I do. And I'll support the nominee of the party, including if he's the nominee.
We heard the announcement very recently that Senator Cruz and Governor Kasich are going to combine forces to try and stop the momentum that Donald Trump has toward the nomination. Can they stop him?
I don't know the answer to that, but what it tells me is that they're worried about him getting to 1237, either on the first ballot or thereafter. I heard Senator Cruz say that neither he nor Mr. Trump could get to 1237 on the first or second ballot. What this tells me is that Senator Cruz and Governor Kasich feel like they're teaming up together, have a better chance to push this to the multiple ballots, thus enhancing one or both of their chances of getting elected. But as I said earlier, this is really unprecedented in my experience. I've never seen anything quite like this. We haven't had an open convention in a long, long time, certainly not with the coverage we'll have of this one on social media and on 24/7 coverage. I think maybe in some ways this will be a useful reminder of what self-government looks like and an encouragement for more people to get involved.
How would you characterize your relationship to Senator Cruz?
It's a good working relationship. He and I agree on most things, particularly when it comes to substance. We've had our differences on tactics or how to accomplish those goals. Part of it from the fact that I've been here a while and I'm now part of elected Republican leadership. My goal has always been to figure out how we can advance the conservative cause, even incrementally at times. when I think he's taken a more immediate, shorter-term view of things. And clearly, he didn't come here to remain in the Senate. He came here to run for president. And I think that's perhaps explained the difference in tactics. But we work together on a regular basis.
Has he asked you for an endorsement?
He has not.
Would you consider it if he did?
I don't really think it's appropriate for me to be picking and choosing in the primaries. One thing, it's pretty dumb politics for a Republican to choose between Republicans in a contested primary, because obviously you're going to be offending some people. And I just think the mood of the country is now that, you know, people don't necessarily want an elected official to tell them how they ought to cast their vote. Matter of fact, it's the opposite. And they want to express themselves, and they have a right to, and I'll respect their choice.
You've been committed to sentencing fraud and criminal justice issues. Can you talk a little bit about what you think needs to change about the way we punish criminals in this country?
Most of my interest and education in the topic of criminal justice reform, I learned from the Texas experience, which is you can try to build your way toward public safety by building more and more and more prisons. The problem is that almost everybody who's in prison gets out of prison at some point. And so just warehousing people in prison is not an answer to them returning to a life of crime and then perhaps returning back through that turnstile back into the criminal justice system. So Texas demonstrated that you can be tough on crime but also smart on crime and provide incentives for inmates to seek to deal with either their education deficits or their chemical or drug addiction, or otherwise deal or better prepare themselves for reentry into civilized society. At the same time, our recidivism rates come down, our crime rates come down, and we've been able to save money and close prisons. The sentencing reform part is a little trickier, but as you know, in the 90s, there was a much more of an emphasis on longer term sentencing, stacking sentences, three strikes and you're out. And I think we sort of evolved in this position that long sentences were the most important thing. I think most people who follow this topic would tell you that the certainty of punishment is much more important than the length of the punishment.
We're sitting here in your office in the Senate, the Hart Senate office building. You don't have a great view out your window, but you do have, I see on the wall, looks like a ZZ Top guitar in front of some bookends with Abraham Lincoln on them.
Doesn't everybody have one? the story on the guitar was when President George W. Bush was inaugurated, they had a party and ZZ Top played. And one of my friends in the Texas legislature had the idea, well, we're going to give these mementos, these guitars signed by ZZ Top to the people who were involved in the president's election. People like Karen Hughes, Joe Albaugh, Karl Rove, and the like. And lo and behold, after that, I happened to be in his office, and I saw he had another one. I said, is that an extra one? He said, yeah, would you like it? So, sure, and that's how it ended up on my wall. It's a nice conversation piece.
Senator Cornyn, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.